welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting from two shipping containers outside Roberta's Pizza.
I just have to say it's a beautiful day, and I hope people are listening to us.
You better be. because next week, Alice and I are officially going outside, and we're going to be working outdoors every day, which we're really excited about. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the Gardeners and Ladies of Groundworks, Inc. And today's show, we're going to talk about sort of a follow-up to last week's show. Last week, we said, okay, we finally have good weather. You need to get out there and start cleaning your gardens or hire someone to do that. Maybe hire us to do it. let's say you're in a situation where you don't really have a garden, you really need help, you want to begin, where do you begin?
You have a space, but you don't know what to do with it.
Exactly.
Let's first mention our sponsor.
Yes, Hearst Ranch's grass-fed beef program.
Yes,
grass-fed. Our sponsor today. So you have an outdoor space, and this might be your first garden, and you don't really know what to do, where to begin. Who should you hire? Should you hire someone at all? Do you need an architect? Do you need a landscape architect, a garden designer, a landscaper? Where do you begin? Well, the first thing that you want to decide is what exactly it is that you want. How do you want to use your outdoor space? Do you want to make a masonry patio? Do you want to make an outdoor living room, a deck? Do you want to dig a swimming pool? Do you want a whole new planting plan, or, you know, a complete overhaul of the whole space? Those are decisions that you kind of have to make, you know, on your own before you choose the kind of person that you hire, because depending on the scope of the work and also kind of the municipality where you live and its building and home improvement codes, that's what's going to determine whether you need an architect or a landscape architect to file plans.
Versus a garden designer or just a landscaper to kind of improvise.
Exactly. So you need to know, especially if you're new to an area, you need to find out, you know, what the rules are.
Because, and if you have to submit to a building code, you know, board.
Well, some towns, for example, like in Scarsdale or in other suburbs where we've worked, you can't do anything without filing plans with an architect and filing it with the town and getting approval. They have very strict codes about even a patios, you know,
fences,
everything. So you can't just be rogue about it, because you will pay the price. They'll make you tear it down.
Well, there's also landmarks here in the city. So, you know, there's, depending on what you want to do, you have to, and you can, you know, nyc.gov will help you determine if you need, you know, what types of regulations you need.
Yeah, that's a good beginning if you're here in the city. So if you do want a, you know, an underground pool or permanent structure like a pergola or shed, you definitely need to get an architect involved to file the plans. However, that being said, for most city and small to medium suburban gardens that really don't require like extensive earthwork or regrading or, you know, building retaining walls or anything like that, usually a qualified garden designer can help you achieve your vision without having to go to an architect.
Or a structural engineer for weight issues.
Exactly. On rooftop gardens, you have to consider that as well. I'm glad that you mentioned that, Alice, because people don't realize that weight is a real issue
and
on roofs.
They soil gets wet and very heavy. And so do tree roots.
Yeah. I mean, most people don't know this, but 1 cubic foot of soil, 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, can weigh between 50 and 100 pounds wet. So that's a lot of weight load on your roof that wasn't there before. helping you decide which kind of person you need to hire, I'm going to like broadly and loosely define the terms of the different people that work in garden areas and what their roles are. An architect, they have to be licensed to practice, and they have to pass like very rigorous tests in order to, you know, practice in various states. So that's why they're the ones that can file with building departments and things like that.
And give you stamped drawings.
Exactly. If you're a co-op or condo, for example, if you live in a co-op or condo, they may want a stamped drawing from an architect. They may want your architect to present to the board before you do any work, because, you know, that impacts everybody else in the building potentially. A landscape architect also is required to be licensed in most states, and they're different. Of course, they're much usually more well-versed in architects in elements of outdoor work, grading, you know, soil work, those kinds of things, drainage. And many of them specialize in one particular kind of work, either residential work, institutional work, or, you know, civic work, you know, making parks. You know, they make playgrounds, they design university campuses, and of course, probably the most famous one and a landscape architect of all time is Frederick Law Olmsted, who, you know, built and designed Central Park and Prospect Park, which I think is better than Central Park.
And many other parks all over the country.
Yes, and campuses, and also I think some private residences too. So, but landscape architects often work with architects on large building projects. They're usually brought in. Now, the third group of individuals are garden designers, and they are a mixed bag. They are not licensed, and they're not required to be licensed. Pretty much anybody can hang out their shingle and call themselves a garden designer. So in this case, you have to be really careful about who you hire. Some have been trained at botanic gardens and have completed some kind of certificate program. Some come from the sort of nursery side and learn about plants on the job. But that doesn't mean that they understand how to build patios or, you know, understand drainage and things like that. So how do you choose? Well, we found that the best way is to ask friends, ask family, and even neighbors whose gardens you admire for a referral. In fact, most of our best projects come from referral. Alice and I almost never advertise because the people that we work with, if they like working with us, you know, it's usually...
We also get a lot of work from landscape architects to implement their designs or to help them with their planting plans because they're not so well versed in plants and appropriateness. But however, they are excellent at structural issues and grading and so sometimes we work in conjunction with architects and landscape architects.
That's true. And also a good point is landscape architects and architects usually don't build out their own projects. There are some that might, but most are not. Most of them
most
don't do that.
Most just do the design and then hand it over to a general contractor or a design build firm. Or just a build firm.
So once you get the referral from a friend or family member or from someone, you want to see a portfolio of their work. If they're not organized enough to have a portfolio either online or in a book, you know,
that's kind of a red flag.
Yeah, that speaks volumes because they're in a visual business, you know. So if you're not, if you don't have work to show, you know, you can't drive potential clients around to see work. I mean, you can, but who has the time to do that? So look for someone whose portfolio shows a variety of work, shows some creativity within the portfolio itself, because that's the first impression that the new potential client will have. Also make sure, especially if you live in a communal building like a co-op or a condo, that they have insurance as well. You know,
Workers' comp and general liability. If something happens, who's responsible?
If they don't have it, you're going to pay. Also, Alice and I found that there has to be, beyond the professional skill of the person, you know, you might have a person that knows a lot about plants, and we run into that sometimes, but they don't have good people skills. So it has to be a good fit between the client and the designer. And we found that the most successful projects are ones where the client and the designer are kind of on the same page, and they really work together towards a common vision. It helps if the client has a little bit of a vision. They don't have to, you know, articulate it in terms that are like, you know, crystal clear, like, oh, this is exactly what I want. But they have to be able to express a little bit, you know,
of how the space is going to be used, who's going to use it.
Because I found that some of the most difficult projects is when the client doesn't know anything about plants and doesn't have a clue about what they want. You know, like it doesn't, they don't
It's like pulling teeth. It's really hard.
Really hard. So it all starts at the beginning. If there's a good fit, you have, you feel like, you know, you click with the person, you kind of know, you know, that it's going to be a good fit. You go with your instincts. And if the designer is really listening to you, and Alice and I found that Sometimes egos get in the way. Some designers have a, you know, they have a certain style of garden they make and that's it. And they try to stuff their, you know, their aesthetic ideologies down somebody's throat. Mm-hmm. And Alice and I don't work that way, just to toot our own horn for a second.
Woo, woo.
Woo-hoo. Well, we think that the garden has to be about the place mm-hmm. and the people that live in it, not about us. Of course we have opinions. You know, for those of you who've been listening to the show for the past few months, yeah. You know we have opinions, but
that's why we're on the radio.
Yeah, we like to listen to hear. You like to hear our own selves talk, but we try not to impose our vision on the client, mm-hmm. and you know we think that that's part of what's made us successful in what we do. So it begins with listening, and I want to stress that the designer's role, step one, is to listen to your desires, your problems, and your issues. For example, you say, "I want privacy. I want a children's or dog area. I want a low maintenance garden. I want a cut flower garden. I want to reduce noise. I want shade. I want, you know, an entertaining and dining space." You know, you have to really listen to the client. And then you have to get into the subject of budget right away. And I can't stress that enough. A lot of times, especially with first time garden makers, they don't have a clue about what
things cost,
and they usually underestimate, mm-hmm. you know, what things cost. Everybody's gone to Home Depot. Everybody's gone to a nursery and bought a plant or two. But what they don't know often is the labor, mm-hmm. you know, cost that's involved. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, a big issue. So it's important to be honest with the designer about what your budget is. It's mm-hmm. not a game. You know what I mean? We're not trying to, you know, take money out of your wallet. You
know? We're trying to create a good product for you
that fits your budget. And right. if we design something that is not within your budget, we've just wasted an enormous amount of time.
Right. And if you say, okay, I've got a $10,000 budget, okay, that's great. We'll design accordingly. But alternatively, if you say you've got a $1,500 budget, we can design accordingly and help you prioritize, you know, for that budget too. Mm-hmm. So our job is to help you succeed with your outdoor space.
And also to help you be realistic. You know, disappointment occurs when people don't have, you mm-hmm. know, realistic expectations.
When they run to Home Depot and they buy a bunch of beautiful flowering, you know, annuals and they stick them in and they think, oh my God, great, I've got a garden. And mm-hmm. then like a month later, oh, all this money that I just spent, why aren't these things blooming? What's mm-hmm. wrong?
Exactly, exactly. So, and when you're budgeting, I want to just say you should pay for design time. Good designers don't give away their designs usually for free, mm-hmm. Especially when you're dealing with a project that involves construction, building a deck, building a patio. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do a quick sketch on a piece of paper, but will that help you really visualize what's happening? Mm-hmm. So with respect to that, it's usually such a tiny fraction of what the whole budget is going to be. If somebody says to you, I will design it for free, that's also sometimes a red flag, you
right,
know, because
right.
they're going to just make you pay for it some other way.
In the long run. Right.
So it's about respect. If you have an interior designer, you're going to pay them, even though they're not the painters. They're not putting down the carpet. They're not, you know, providing the furniture necessarily, but you're paying for advice. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's valuable.
And for advocacy, basically, with all the other trades involved, a mason or a carpenter, or so that the client is getting the integral design that was designed. Does that make sense? So that they are getting the design that they are buying. That's what the designer can do.
And Alice is right. They're your advocate. We, for example, Alice and I are a design build firm. So we design and we build, obviously. But many times we have to subcontract out certain elements like lighting, irrigation. Mm-hmm. So because you've paid for our time, we are on your side. We represent you and mm-hmm. not, you know, the contractor. Now, that being said, so you listened to the client, you talked about budget. Now we have to, our job as designers is to articulate your desires into garden language. What does that mean? If you say to us, my desire is privacy, we figure out fencing for you. If you say, I want to reduce noise, we figure out hedging or something appropriate mm-hmm. in that regard. So, and part of the articulation is the visuals and the plans that the designer provides. This is the most important tool in the communication process. You know, I can say to you, I'm going to make you a perennial border. That means nothing to most people. So the designer has to translate the vision into understandable language. I know what a yew hedge is going to look like or a mixed herbaceous border, but does the client know? Mm-hmm. So the plans are very important, you know, and that's that step. And making a garden, as Alice mentioned before, is very different from renovating a kitchen or a bath. Most people are very competent to go pick out tile, pick out kitchen cabinets. But in the realm of gardens and in plants, most clients don't have the knowledge to make those choices. They don't have, you know, the horticultural knowledge to choose plants. So they really rely on the skills of the plants person and the designer.
Who knew from plants?
Right. So then after you've got the plan, then you have to kind of refine it. And this is where the client really has to kind of sit up and listen. In this step, what happens, I think, is desire bumps up against budget. Yeah. And then they have to be reconciled. Compromises and choices have to be made. And in this step, the ideas are really concretized and a real budget and plan is finalized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the final step is building it. Now, depending on, like I said previously, the role of the designer, if they're a design build firm, they're going to proceed to schedule and coordinate all the different elements of the project, the masons, the carpenters, the lighting people, irrigation.
Yeah.
Exactly. If they're strictly designers, their job now is to provide you with the tools to bid out the work to competent garden builders. So they're your advocates, and that's why you pay for the design. So, be prepared for surprises. Like any other renovation project, there's going to be delays, and you know you can only anticipate so much. As you start to excavate, you don't know what you're going to find underground. You know,
Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, you may find Jimmy Hoffa or a concrete patio or a buried tank. So be flexible. You know, if the designer says it's going to take a month, it might take 5 weeks or 6 weeks. You know. And finally, I'd like to say, when you're budgeting, remember the maintenance. Ongoing maintenance is critical to successful gardens over time. So you have to budget. You know, every garden needs maintenance, even a low maintenance garden. It's not a no maintenance garden. It's low maintenance. So you have to either plan to do it yourself or, you know, pay somebody to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice and I, of course, do all these different things. And that's why, you know, after so many years of doing it, we've come to the conclusion that clients who don't value maintenance, you know,
don't really understand what they're embarking on.
No. And they're not really
interested in a garden.
No, they're more interested in an outdoor room. And that's a very different thing, you know,
which I will talk about in a moment.
Yes. Alice is going to talk about style, different kinds of garden styles in a minute. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants, Heritage Radio Network. That was Frank Black, Abstract Plane. Since we're kind of talking about garden design, we all kind of want to live on an abstract plane, I think, sometimes. So now we're talking about designing your own plane in your own space. And you know how some years it's kind of shabby chic that's in style, which is like old and rusty and cottage style and messy. And then other years it's totally mod with clean straight lines and geometric patterns and minimal monochromatic plantings. And then there's the exotic years, the Italianate or the Roman style gardens.
It always circles around,
yeah,
right? It just comes back around.
And you know, you look at the garden design magazines and they always have like the what's hot this year. year. And, you know, maybe it's Asian gardens or Zen gardens or Indian gardens with flower, like, you know, floral fabrics and hanging lanterns. And, you know, it really is about style and what's hot and what's not. So you look at these, you know, trade magazines, and you look at the pictures and you think, wow, I want to have this garden. And you know, your garden designer, you have this appointment with your garden designer, and she comes, and or he comes, and you show the designer this picture, and they say, that's great, but that's Southern California and we're in New York, or you know, we're in Atlanta and you're looking at a Seattle based garden.
Yeah.
So you really have to think about regionalism when it comes to planning a garden. And defining style is what makes a garden great. That's why those pictures look so great. But it's okay to import that kind of stylistic vision into your regional place.
Mm-hmm.
So we always suggest that the garden be a reflection of the client so that it doesn't seem imported or too stylistic. So there's ways of creating that kind of Southern California border with New England style plants. Gardens are very, very personal, and they should really articulate the personality of the client and the landscape that they are going to exist in. So for instance, native plantings can resemble a prairie landscape, or bamboo and maples to reflect an Asian landscape.
You don't have to have, you know, a Chinese scholar's garden to have a flavor of Asian. If your home has a lot of Asian accents, or that mm-hmm. your taste tend towards that, sometimes just a few touches is enough. You don't need overkill.
And the garden should really be a reflection of your interior space. It should carry through, you know, it shouldn't be like completely separate and different. It should be the way you live, so to speak, in the general sense.
Exactly.
So if you're into like French and formalism, then you should think about a parterre garden, and you should have bedding plants to create formality. If you're kind of loose, you know, and beachy, then you want to have a kind of beachy style garden, which would be Rosa Ricosas and kind of gnarly pines and sea oats and a more looser style. Or, you know, woodland plantings, hostas and trilliums and dogwoods to create this kind of natural, you know, upstate New York
feeling.
Kind of garden.
Like if your home is kind of cabin-like and rustic and, you know, you use found objects. But, you know, you can also contrast the garden starkly with the interiors too. If you really want, you know, the garden space to be, you know, radical, I mean, that can be done as well. You know, if you want a meditation room or something like that,
sure.
You know, it can be starkly different, but it usually works if it's a flow
mm-hmm.
from the indoors,
some sort
to the
of complementary
mm-hmm.
and you can do that through materials, through fabrics, for instance. You can, you know, the fabrics that you use inside could be imported somehow to the outdoor dining table, perhaps. Lighting fixtures can create a great sense of style in a garden. Paper lanterns versus ship lanterns, like that kind of style. Plant choices can reflect and also set the tone of the style of garden, like, you know, bamboo for Asian gardens, or like I was just saying, Rosa Rugosas for beach gardens. There's also sand and rock accents. Zen gardens, you know, can be produced using sand. Dry alpine rockery gardens, you know, can emit a feeling of high up altitude.
And mosses, even just a small patch of a mossy area or mossy rocks can give a feeling of the woodland, you know, without having to plant a bunch of precious, you know, one week blooming trilliums, you know what I mean?
Right, like, right. And lawn, you know, do you want some lawn in your garden? And then if you do decide you want lawn because you've got kids or you've got a garden or a dog perhaps, should that be artificial lawn?
Mm-hmm.
Or should it be real sod, you know? And then again, like Carmen suggested, maintenance. How are you going to maintain that? For instance, a lot of our brownstone kind of Park Slope, Brooklyn Heights, you know, Midtown brownstone gardens, they want to have lawn. So, well, how are you going to bring a lawnmower through your brownstone to mow it? Or are you going to get out there, you know, every 6 or 7 days with a quiet, you know, environmentally friendly push mower? Are you really going to mow the lawn? Those are the type of realistic conversations
you're not
that you need to be having, you know? And that's why maybe you should think about the artificial turf as an idea. I'm just throwing it all out there. Mm-hmm. So the types of containers that you use can also tell a lot about the style of the garden you're creating. For example, glazed for like an Asian inspired motif. Terracotta is good for a kind of Mediterranean style garden. You could look for mosaic kind of containers for Indian or Middle Eastern style gardens. For a garden to feel complete and all of these elements really should complement each other. So, for instance, say you inherit you're blessed to have an existing geometric bluestone patio, right? Which would be like large stones cut from rectangular pieces. It would be silly to design a garden for like an Asian inspired garden around this kind of patio style because it's already dictated by these big slabs. So rather, this patio style is more mid-century modern or Italian or French because of the formality that's inherent in the patio that you've been blessed with.
But that hasn't stopped people from doing it.
Yeah. So,
but and doing some mishmashing.
Yeah, there is, you know, but my point is that form should follow function, and form dictates the success of your space. So then the material choices that you make are very, very important to creating a very good stylistic garden. So as garden designers, we approach clients with the most basic question: how do you want to use the space, and who's going to use the space? These two questions, more than any other two questions, in my opinion, really determine the outcome. So the third question, as Carmen discussed, is budget. Mm-hmm. How much can you spend on it now, and how much can you spend on it in the following years? A lot of times, as budgets are tight, especially these days, garden installations are phased. That is, the project will roll over into following years or into subsequent planting seasons. Prioritizing and being realistic about how the space will be used will create the successful design for now and for the future.
And there's definitely an order of things. You know, if you if you have in the plan a patio and plantings, you need to do the patio first. Mm-hmm. You know, and
or
maybe
the carpentry first, or right. And that's why a master plan, you know, pay for the master plan, and then as funds come available in subsequent years, then you can implement them.
Sure.
So that will determine how the site is initially cleaned up, how patios and decking are installed and laid out. So a lot of times, most of our clients work with us this way. So they'll pay for the master plan, and then we'll come up with kind of a schedule of how that is going to be implemented.
Yeah, and remember, you can plant in the fall too.
Yes.
You know, Alice and I stress that a lot of times for our clients, we don't have to panic plant, you know, only April, May, and June. You can do some work like the masonry in the spring or build a deck, and then in the fall, you can plant or the following spring.
Mm-hmm. That's also going to determine what type of plantings you want. Like if you want to, like it helps you prioritize. So if you want a hedge, is that hedge going to be, or I'm sorry, if you want like screening, is that going to be a hedge or is that going to be a fence? And then you can prioritize based on your budget, you know, how it's going to be implemented. So if you, you know, say you've got a rubble strewn backyard, what's first? You know, clean it out. That's first. And then sit with the designer and talk about how, you know, what you want that space to look like, and then figure out how you're going to actually implement it based on your budget. That's why a master plan and a relationship with a garden designer is really a long-term relationship.
Yes, we have clients that we've had for 8 years or more because their gardens are evolving, and their style also changes.
Exactly. And say they want, you know, a large tree, you know, they know that in the future they want like a big, large shade tree, you know, because their site is like super hot or something. So, but they don't have a big budget. So maybe it's worth, you know, in paying for that tree to be installed early so that later on you have that shade, and then you can put your patio underneath that canopy and enjoy your harvest table dinner. You know?
Exactly. And also, as we noticed this past week, Mother Nature knocks down trees, and gardens that were shady are now sunny.
Right, right. So like Carmen said, be flexible.
Yes.
But really, a garden is a process. And Carmen kind of touched on this earlier about the whole like bathroom and kitchen thing. It's not something that's done and then you walk away from it. You keep working on a garden because it grows and it changes, and nature, like, you know, trees falling over, happen. So gardens are very specific in their design. And it takes a lot of work up front to really get that kind of picture perfect, you know, Garden Design Magazine image.
And keep in mind, those images in those magazines, that's a photo shoot.
It is a photo shoot.
And those have been manicured to death right before the photographer got in, of course.
Yeah,
you know?
By staff, you know, by a staff of 10, you know, photo people and gardeners.
Yeah.
So,
and keep in mind that your garden is yours. Mm-hmm. It's okay to go out there and mess around in it, even if you have a gardener.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. In fact, you should, because you should know what its strong points are and what its weak points are. And a garden is never a complete project. It's a process that changes with the seasons and the years. And that's the beauty of it. It's not a bathroom that's finished in a few weeks. It will, because of seasons and time
and harsh winters,
become its own thing. So that's why the materials you choose are really a reflection of yourself. So gardens are really environments that live and breathe and grow and die. They do.
Yeah,
they do. Die. And
plants die.
It's a fantasy. A garden is really a fantasy of far off places. So the materials and the layout are very important to the articulation of such spaces. And now we're going to take another break. And I'm going to pay a bit of tribute to our old friend that died too soon this week, Alex Chilton, and to a song about a fantasy place that I hope he's at right now. This is India Song by Alex Chilton. Welcome back. We Dig Plants, Heritage Radio Network. Now, we just kind of want to wrap up today's segment with some products that we're excited about this year in planting gardens. And the first is this hanging pot holder that's called the Cinch.
It's a cinch.
It's an adjustable stainless steel wire hanger for pots, and it seems to kind of fade away so that the pot appears to be floating in space. It's a great departure from the hunky macrame 1970s.
Although the macrame is back.
It's back. I know it's back.
Unfortunately.
I know it's back. But I like this one better.
Me too.
So the Cinch is available at gardenbasket.com. And the other one that I really like is from Gardner Supply Company, and it's basically these metal corner brackets that screw into boards for making raised beds. So it's a great way of squaring up boards so that you can make raised container beds for veggies or flower beds.
That's great for people who aren't, you know, sort of mechanically inclined or carpentry inclined.
Yeah, I don't want to like be fussing around with screws. I want to be planting, you know.
Yeah, and if your soil is really poor and you don't really want to do the backbreaking work of digging out just make a raised bed.
Yeah.
And you'll put brand new soil in an Insta garden in that way.
Exactly. So these are these metal brackets that actually square up boards. Gardener Supply Company. And the other thing that we're really excited about this year, and it's a little passé, but reclaimed masonry and wood. Use this stuff that you guys find. Please keep it from going into the landfills. Used bricks can create gorgeous patios. In fact, some of our clients pay a lot of money to get reclaimed brick in instead of using new brick because they want that old world look. And large slabs of wood can be, you know, old doors, you know, clean them up, use them for garden tables or, you know, doors for interesting entryways into gardens. Fence posts, you know, can be used as hammock stakes, you know, use this old stuff because.
And garden sculpture. I've found some great trash, you know, that I've ended up using as sculpture in my garden. And even some of my garden furniture is found. It's amazing, especially in New York, how much people throw out that's still really usable. I found vintage 50s chairs,
right,
all kinds of great stuff.
But what I meant is earlier when I was talking about style, yeah, you have to edit this stuff. I mean, be careful because you don't want it to look like a junk show, you know. You want it to be stylistically appropriate. So just because it's found doesn't necessarily mean that it's like
good.
Perfect, you know. And the other thing that I love, and I'm always surprised when I see it in a garden, and I think it's great, is driftwood. I feel like a piece of driftwood has a story to tell about where it came from, and you know what beach it used to be on, or what ship it fell off of, and I like that there's a story inherent in that because I think that's what gardens are all about: a story and a place and a time and a fantasy, you know. So
much more than kitchens and bathrooms, Alice.
Exactly. Exactly.
They don't inspire fantasy.
Right. No. Well,
not for me.
Yeah. I'm happier in the garden. Let's just keep it that way. So, Carmen, I think you have some special events you want to talk about.
Yes, I have one special event, actually. One of my favorite nurseries, local nurseries, actually, is Rare Fine Nursery in Jackson, New Jersey. They have a great selection of shrubs, flowering shrubs, many of them native, and some really rare things, hence the name, Rare Find. And they are having, considering the winter that we've had, an appropriate class, First Aid for Injured Plants, a pruning workshop. And after this horrible winter, I suggest that you head out there and take it because it's free. It's Saturday, March 27th from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. And Rare Finds nurserywoman Ann Haynes is going to explain and demonstrate the whys and wherefores of pruning.
Wherefores.
That's from their website. We'll put a link to their website on our Facebook fan page after the show. There's going to be a morning session at 10:30 and an afternoon session at 1:30. So you just, you know, go to their website, choose which session you'd like to attend, and then you sign up. And importantly, it's free. Most pruning classes cost, you know, $75 or $100, $200. And this is a really great opportunity to learn hands-on from one of the best nurserymen in the area.
And it'll be beautiful because things will be swelling and budding.
Yeah, they have a witch hazel festival every year. Mm-hmm. So they specialize in witch hazels and magnolias and things like that. So that wraps up our show for today. We'd like to thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're also going to post a questionnaire on our Facebook fan page pertaining to garden design, questions to help you figure out what you want.
And think about your space.
Exactly. And you can check that out at Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. We want more fans. We're asking you guys to tell your friends about us.
And you know what? We're gonna pick each week of the new fans. New fans, we're going to pick one special person and send them a gift. So,
to become a fan,
we're
bribing you.
So, and we'll contact you and we'll get your address and we'll send you a nice little
gardening
surprise gift.
So we're also going to, of course, put a link to the products that we mentioned, the nursery that we mentioned. We'd like to thank Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street, and Jack Inslee for producing, Nat Wiener for engineering, and of course, Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Program as our sponsor today. We look forward to seeing you in the gardens. Send us pictures of your gardens if you have them. We'd like to see them. And until next week, happy gardening.
Thank you so much.